This episode of the Press Row Podcast is sponsored by Cards Against Humanity's 10 Days or Whatever of Kwanzaa. You give Cards Against Humanity $15 and they'll send you 10 mystery gifts for the 10 Days or Whatever of Kwanzaa. Space is limited to the first 250,000 people who sign up at holidaybullshit.com. This episode of the Press Row Podcast is also brought to you, of course, by Operation Sports. Operation Sports is your home for sports video gaming news, insight, rosters, sliders, and online communities, and of course, the Press Row Podcast, and so much more, too. Operation Sports, dedicated to sports gaming. Go ahead.
Hello, this is the Press Row Podcast with my daddy.
Welcome to the Press Row Podcast, brought to you by Operation Sports. I'm your host, Richard Grisham. Well, all right. Hey, everybody. How are you? Welcome to the Press Row Podcast for your Friday, November 15th, 2014. I am Rich Grisham. As always, I am very, very happy that you have decided to join us today. We've got a sort of a special episode here. I've got two of my good friends joining me tonight. We have up first from Pasta Padre, Mr. Brian Weedy. Brian, welcome.
Thanks. I always look forward to these special episodes. They're the best ones.
I think you're right. And we also have, of course, from Polygon, Owen Good. Owen, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks very much for having me on the show, Richard.
You got it, my man. So it's been a bit of a tough week for people who love video games, particularly those who love the big AAA video games. This week saw the release of Assassin's Creed Unity. It saw the release of Halo Master Chief Collection, two games which were, by and large, absolute disasters. And when we say absolute disasters, we mean it in a couple of different ways. Assassin's Creed Unity, ridden with bugs, major problems. Also had a significant amount of microtransactions that were hidden from most of, if not all of, the people who were given a little bit of early access to the game. And there were embargoes that were placed upon reviews for Assassin's Creed that were after the release, the retail release of it. Halo Master Chief Collection came out, and for the better part of the first few days after release, very few people could consistently get into online matchmaking, which is basically the heart and soul of Halo. And these two games are just the latest in a series of real significant missteps along the way. And obviously, this is a sports video game show, but sports video games are part of the greater video game world at large. And this is exactly 1 year from the release of the PlayStation 4. And there have been, as I mentioned, many, many games with many issues. Battlefield 4 at the launch, NBA 2K14, major problems. NBA 2K15 at the launch, major problems. Lots and lots of others. Almost surprisingly too many to name. In fact, the exceptions nowadays are games that work well at launch. Games like Titanfall, for example, and for at least the most part, like the latest Call of Duty. You know, you look at Drive Club, for example, which is another game that had significant parts of it just not working. So these are very difficult days, and in some parts. And I wanted to get together with Brian and Owen, Brian being an independent guy and Owen working for a major outlet, and just talk about this, obviously within within sports video games, framing it, but also just games as a whole. And where we are right now from a standpoint of the business practices, from the reviews, and from just the experience as a consumer, and also from ourselves, you know, myself and Brian and Owen, how we communicate effectively when the games that we are talking about are so big and so broad, and the way that we feel about games may be very different than the way that other people feel. So it's going to be an interesting discussion. I'm looking forward to it. So we're going to start a little bit with the concept of the day one review and the business practices. I'm going to start with you, Owen. Assassin's Creed Unity, as I mentioned, there were embargoes that were put on the review of that game until well after its retail release. And there were microtransactions that are in the game that were completely hidden. There were significant problems in the single-player mode. And embargoes are are obviously a common thing. And, you know, most of the sports games that we cover have embargoes that are usually on the release date anymore. And yet most sites really want to get a review out there on day one. So, I mean, Owen, just what are your thoughts on the concept of a day one review in today's environment where these games are so big and these infrastructures so complex? How can the two possibly work together?
Well, my offhand appraisal of that is we should just stop having day one reviews as a goal. These things are increasingly, you know, have increasingly sophisticated online modes that simply can't be appraised pre-release. I mean, there will be sometimes multiplayer events for press that have early, you know, release copies. I'm remembering, you know, Forza Horizon a couple of years ago had one, and you could see how the modes worked, but you weren't able to appraise whether you could connect to the servers, whether there were matchmaking problems, the things that you're seeing with Halo the Master Chief Collection. And while Halo the Master Chief Collection, you know, is for the four numbered Halo games in high definition, and, you know, they have, you know, very long, deep campaigns. That's a game that, it, you know, multiplayer is, I mean, for many people, it's more than half. It's for many people, it's like the whole point. And, you know, if you've got you need time, you know, to assess these things. And looking at my own, you know, work lately, the one game, the one sports title that I think hit day of release, a day of release embargo was NBA Live 15. That's for me. Right. Our NBA 2K15 release review didn't come out until 3 weeks after the fact. I felt like that was a screw up. I felt like we didn't do something that was timely there. But it did allow us to capture and properly appraise, you know, the problems that it was having, especially as it was doing all of these ambitious things in its, you know, online modes, and then how the rest of the game depended on that. And then, you know, if you're still having problems 3 weeks in, you know, that's a serious issue. You know, that's not just, whoops, this, you know, here's a day one patch, which, you know, you're seeing so many games do now. You know, that's a problem, and that, you know, necessarily affects the review score, and it kept us at least from having to go back and revisit it, which no one wants to do. But I'm coming to the conclusion that day one reviews, it's like this. The rub is, are you making a consumer recommendation or are you making a critical appraisal of, right, you know, or a creative work?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've worked, you know, for two publications, and the strong sense is we're going to make a, you know, a critical appraisal of an expressive work. But these things are not $10 movie tickets. They're $60 purchases. And you sort of feel an obligation, especially to a public that you have, you know, that has been reading what you've written about these games pre-release. You know, you owe it to them to say, you know, did they execute on their vision? Now, what's happened with Assassin's Creed, and I'm interested to get Brian's reactions to this, because, you know, Brian is the kind of guy who, if I'm not mistaken, Brian, you go buy your own copies, and sometimes if you're going to get anything pre-release, you got to wheedle and cajole a local store to give one to you, right?
Absolutely right.
Yeah, so I'm interested in your thoughts on that as an outsider. I do know that my thoughts on the inside of this is what you saw with Assassin's Creed. You know, NBA Live 15 had a noon embargo on day of release, same as Assassin's Creed. Now, that game also was available in a six-hour trial on EA Access over Xbox One, and sites like Operation Sports, you know, had, you know, long threads, and Brian, you had coverage as well, you know, based off of that. So it wasn't like there was a total, you know, obfuscation of what this game was all about. If people wanted to know, they could go find information. Wasn't the case with Assassin's Creed, which I felt was just abusive in how Ubisoft handled that. And, you know, what you're seeing is sort of the mainstream or the video games press at large. You know, this is the kind of thing we kind of deal with in sports video games a lot. You don't get the review copy. Rarely do you get it in advance enough to do a decent day one review. And usually your editors don't care. You just run the review later because, let's be honest, you know, this is a segment that doesn't traffic as high as Call of Duty, as Assassin's Creed, and those sorts of things. But when it happens to Assassin's Creed, people get mad. And Brian, I'll throw it over to you with this. It's just, you know, the posture on this from the micromanagement of the launch day and making sure that this embargo went up at noon so that it could, you know, have a nice 12-hour run where everything was pristine and controlled by Ubisoft's hype machine. And then, of course, the microtransactions, you know, this speaks of a publisher taking its audience for granted. And that is just the cardinal sin in sports video gaming, that some are still, you know, learning, but others are at least figuring out how to be a little more respectful to gamers as they pursue their agendas of annual releases and microtransactions.
Yeah, I think you're seeing that a lot now. People have caught on to the idea of if a review is coming late, if there's an embargo that's holding it back, if they're not showing you footage, there's probably something wrong. I mean, we're used to that in movies now. If a movie isn't screened to reviewers early, you can pretty much be assured it's going to be awful. Now, day one reviews are still, they're very important because, yes, it's going to shape the purchase decisions of many people. You want to paint a picture for consumers so that they can make the best decision possible. But now you have to have that understanding that it's not going to be the whole picture. You cannot get a sense of how a game is going to run with the public online before it releases, even if you just, like I would do, get a hold of a copy some other way, or you're playing through EA Access or whatever. You can't know how everything's going to work on release day. So those reviews come out, and they're often either inflated. Well, more often than not, they're going to have inflated scores before the issues are discovered. But at the same time, you don't want to just leave consumers in the dark. And that's part of the whole problem with embargoes, in my view, is not so much even review related. It's that it influences how coverage is made on a game in the days leading up to release. So if someone who actually gets a copy, there were people who got copies of different sports games early on, and we found out information from those people as opposed to the publishers and their usual marketing rollout. How do they cover it? Do they cover that news that's coming from other people, knowing that they're under embargo for their, because they have a copy of the game? And maybe in a case like yours, Owen, with a site like Polygon, you can, because you can have a different author write about it, I suppose. But anyone who's under an embargo can't even cover that stuff, because who's, you know, the company's going to assume they got that information out of their own copy, and then they're breaking embargo if they write about it. So it's a dangerous situation, and we see it with sports games. We see it less now because EA has the EA Access program, so they can't hide stuff. People learned a ton about NHL, what it was missing from that, not from the reviewers later on. The first news on that came out of EA Access, and people who dug up information before the game was even offered, before EA was even talking about what the game was going to have in it. So it's an interesting dilemma, though. I find it's fascinating to see how different places handle it. To me, it's something I prefer to avoid completely. But at the same time, you have to find different ways to be informative. And I think you can do that outside of the realm of the agreeing to a very restrictive embargo.
Well, there are a lot of different ways that you can go, and the media, the games media in particular, is changing very quickly. I mean, YouTubers are obviously wildly popular now. 3, 4, 5 years ago, they were, you know, barely a even a thought. Podcasts, I mean, this show is an example of where we have conversations about sports games weeks and months after they come out. You know, so the conversations continue. But there's still an important aspect to the day one review because of a few things. Number one, digital purchases are becoming more and more common, and digital purchases are being pushed and rewarded by the publishers, and the rewards are often by pre-ordering the games, whether you pre-order them digitally or whether you pre-order them at retail. So the publishers, you know, it's easy to say, gee, I don't pre-order games, right? I mean, it's just easy for people to get on a pedestal, and I put myself in there included because I've said it before, don't pre-order games. But on the other hand, if you don't pre-order a game, you might not get some of the cool stuff that may interest you. And you also, if you don't have a game on day one, quite often you will miss out on the opportunity to experience some things with your friends for the first time. And that's a powerful, it's a powerful reason that it's why people love to play games. Like they want to play with their friends and they want to experience it all together. So, it's a very difficult area where, when you get a game right off the bat, it matters. And if you have no idea before you buy that game, you're really taking a significant risk. And, I just find it fascinating as these things evolve, how different outlets, do continue to call audibles on how they're going to do things, not only outlets, but even the, even the publishers themselves. Now, Brian, you don't even do reviews. You do various pieces on games and obviously here on the show and on the Hangouts, we talk about them in the early days. Why have you elected to not give a review and a review score in the traditional sense on, day one or day two or day three?
That's a long story. I never felt that giving a score, first of all, to a sports game, like we've talked about, there's so much in these games now, and has been in the past, and how you play the game and what you go into, it really varies from person to person. So how do I give a score to Madden, in which I care nothing about Ultimate Team, but then there's a huge sect of people who play nothing but Ultimate Team. So it's kind of unfair. I can frame it in a sense and say, 3 out of 5 stars, 4 out of 5 stars because of what I have in my mind. But really the experience varies from person to person. And there's just too much going on in these games to just put a flat score on it, in my opinion. That would present, that would be more informative than what I'm trying to do in the articles I write up or the podcasts we do and all that. I think that goes into it better. So I've just kind of avoided that, avoided the whole review thing, avoided the Metacritic thing, because I feel like outside of that, I can be more informative.
Now, Owen, you mentioned, the day one review. You would like the day one review to go away, unless, of course, you've had plenty of time with the game. Now, from a perspective of traffic, though, whether it's a sports game or not, does having a review that's not available day one or day two or day three significantly hurt the amount of hits that article will get? And does that, I would imagine, has to come in to influence the decision on when you do run a review?
Well, there's a weird relationship with traffic on this, and it's never affected it to the point where somebody's spoken to me about it in that way. Somebody might have said, especially with the NBA 2K15 review, we really need to get this up. But, that's more in just, being timely. I think reviews, and this is sort of a spitball thing to say, but I think a lot of people have their minds made up about a game, at least the hardcore, who are reading things on day one. I think a lot of them have their minds made up, and they either want to see, an affirmation that, yes, this is okay, and the hopes that I got up for this thing are justified, and, I made a good decision to pre-order it, which I want to get to that in a second. Or they hate the game, and they've spotted something about it that they think is shady, and they want to read somebody, kick its ass. And those kinds of things, those kinds of interests can be served, day of, 2 days after, 1 week after, that sort of thing. So I don't know. Traffic has never really played into it with me. And traffic is one of these things, this is a whole other discussion about how traffic works. We don't, people sort of get the idea that each click is directly monetized, and it doesn't really go that way. But getting back to the other thing, the day one thing and whether or not somebody made a good decision on a pre-order.
Yeah.
And I've got to say this. I don't agree that this is a caveat emptor thing and that it's on consumers to not pre-order and to withhold pre-ordering, to teach these publishers a lesson. If you're pre-ordering not necessarily, you know, from a I expect this to be 9 out of 10 game of the year, you know, the most profound experience that I've ever had. You know, that's an unreasonable expectation, and you should wait and read a critical review. But Assassin's Creed is a known quantity. I mean, that's a series that's had annual releases, I mean, 8 releases and annually since 2008. You know what you think you know what you're getting with Assassin's Creed, and if you pre-order on the expectation that that's not broken, and that it at least mimics the experience that I enjoyed in Black Flag or Assassin's Creed 3, you know, then you've made a reasonable assumption. I mean, at some point we have to hold the people who make these products accountable for having them working at launch. And I think it's a very reasonable expectation to go, you know what, by God, I'm going to pre-order Far Cry 4 because I really enjoyed Far Cry 3. And I know that people are saying Far Cry 4 is going to be like Far Cry 3.5, but that's fine because I still want that open world action movie, you know, sprawling, you know, do anything, you know, kind of environment. And that's fine by me. And so long as Ubisoft delivers a game that works along those parameters, then you've made a good decision. Now, if you want to pre-order Far Cry 4 because you think this thing is going to be, you know, the game of the year and its story is just going to completely blow you away and it's going to be transformative and take the series to new heights, then I think you've made a poor decision and you probably need to hold off and get something to back that up. I think you're setting yourself up to be disappointed there. But to pre-order based on the expectation that the game functions is valid. And in fact, I think the righteous indignation that you hear from gamers, you know, based on that, you know, is powerful and should be what jerks and not the publishers to get things straight so that they're not basically just releasing an alpha or a beta version for the first week and then cleaning it up with a patch, you know, after that. And to echo what you said also, I agree, you know, Rich, you know, there is a great deal of enjoyment in playing these things on the day of release with a lot of friends.
I think it's interesting what you bring up there too, Owen, in pre-ordering based on kind of a history with a series, because we have that in sports games too. I mean, people are ready to pre-order NBA 2K16 because they like 2K15, or mm-hmm. You know, you can go through them all. And so what really irritates people the most, and when you see people jump ship, is when they hide information of things that have been removed. It's not even so much the game didn't improve enough. It's they took out this mode or they took out this feature. And mm-hmm. we saw that recently with NHL. And yet you still have the publishers trying to withhold information as long as they possibly can. And that only offends people even more.
Yeah, you know, the latest version of that, as I mentioned at the top, is Ubisoft having significant content in Assassin's Creed Unity that is microtransaction-driven, which, again, microtransactions are nothing new. We've been talking about them in sports games, and we'll talk about them even more on the show, you know, as we go on. But to completely, you know, just to completely hide that, not only you do what NHL did, which is a couple days before your NHL launch, finally say, here's the list of what's in the game, but to even give people access to the game and hide it until somebody flips a switch on release date is taking it to new heights. And then what I find even more interesting is that a couple of days later, Ubisoft comes out and says, well, we're working to adapt our services and communications with customers accordingly, both by changing the way that we work with reviewers and by offering customers open betas or other early access to some games. They already did that for this game. And then they go on to say, having the online elements available and having populated worlds is essential to creating a representative and complete experience for reviewers. Achieving this prior to launch is incredibly complex, which is why some games are being reviewed much closer, or as was the case with Destiny, even after the game launches. I find that incredibly borderline offensive that Ubisoft mentions a game by another publisher when trying to defend their completely borked release of Assassin's Creed Unity. It's shocking that this kind of stuff comes out. What I'm trying to understand is, and none of us develop video games, but we have been covering video games for quite some time. These systems, the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4, are supposedly incredibly powerful and supposedly built for online and supposedly built for social connectivity. And yet the games that have launched in the 1 year since the PS4 and the Xbox One have been out, I cannot recall a year with the kind of games being released with such massive problems for extended periods of time. What is it? Is it that the games are just too ambitious? Is it that the systems aren't truly built to allow what the games are doing? Are the teams not big enough? I struggle to come up with a reason why game after game after game has such massive problems. I mean, every game has issues, but I cannot recall an extended period of time where so many. I mean, nobody thought Halo Master Chief Collection would be completely busted from an online perspective. I mean, people weren't even talking about that, and yet here it is. I mean, Brian Weedy, what do you think it is? Are the games too big? Are the systems not designed properly? I mean, what's your gut tell you is the root cause of all of these different types of problems, not just in major games, but you know, even in sports games as well with some of the problems we've seen?
Yeah, well, first of all, I would say a lot of it is that so many of these companies now are tying online connectivity into the entirety of their game. So as opposed to in the past where you had, if there was a server issue, maybe you'd get dropped from your online game. Now you can't even play your normal modes in games like NBA 2K if that happens. So I think it's just farther reaching the effects of it when there are issues. But then it's going to vary from case to case. And I think in sports games at least, the investment just simply isn't made on the back end. And you end up with, whether it's coding, I mean, you go back to, Owen had the piece a few years ago where it was, I believe it was NBA 2K12, and yeah. 2K said they were just transitioning from Dreamcast tech and servers. So, you know, 10 years later, I think that's what it ends up going back to generally is they're not prepared for the rush on day one. They plan out and say, okay, here's what we need, because you know, 25%, then 50% of people are going to drop off over the months, and they don't want to keep those costs going all year. So they kind of find a point in the middle where they're like, okay, this is the server capacity we'll need in January. And then instead of investing more in it, I don't know. But there's a lot of issues behind the scenes. And I think even going back to discussions with developers on the show, who would gripe to me privately that the investment just wasn't being made in online, and whether that's because you can't monetize it, which isn't the issue anymore because 2K clearly monetizes everything in the game, including online, because you need to be online to do any of it. So I think it's going to vary game to game. It's harder for me to say why those issues are there for a Halo versus an NBA 2K, but they shouldn't be. I mean, there was a hashtag on Twitter going around the last few days. You know, we landed on a comet, but we can't do blank. You know, we landed on a comet, but we can't play a nice game of MLB The Show online. You know,
Owen, good, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, that's because we built the lander and the vehicle and the code for getting that lander and vehicle to the comet. You know, all by itself. I mean, these are iterative works. And I don't want this to sound like making excuses, but if you thought, you know, in the NBA 2K series had problems, legacy problems in its net code, you know, going back to 2K13, 2K12, 2K11, 2K10, you know, this was off of a code base that stretches back to the Dreamcast, you know, and handling people who are connecting over dial-ups. And then in 2011, they overhauled that and it didn't go so well, but they did overhaul it and, you know, they still had problems. So, you know, yes, these are sophisticated, powerful machines. You know, they have a hardware upgrade, you know, that's, you know, whatever order of magnitude above the previous console generation. And they're supposed to connect people and have all these online experiences, but you're still dealing with people. In a lot of cases, you're still dealing with games that were programmed, you know, for older consoles. I mean, you know, Master Chief Collection is a great example of that. I mean, you know, do we really expect them to rewrite their online code base for, you know, all of those Halo games? I mean, I'm sure that they had to. I don't know. I'm sure they had to do something to modernize that, especially if you're talking about, you know, Halo 2 now being in high definition. You know, I'm sure that's got a lot to do with, you know, hit boxes and lag and latency and all that other stuff and online multiplayer there. But I think you're still dealing with, you know, an architecture that was built and was pretty rock solid. It was just on a previous console generation there. It's hard to know what is fair criticism anymore, because these are such big sprawling works. And Brian, I think you also made a great point about, you know, yes, a lot of these problems, you know, develop in the first 3 weeks because that's when everybody's hitting it. And then people drop off, and no, you know, nobody wants to pay for, you know, servers that, you know, are not being used just because, you know, so you could support launch week capacity. Great. But, you know, now they're all gone. But at the same time, you know, NBA Live didn't have many problems because NBA Live's population is a lot smaller. I get that. But Madden had, you know, some desync issues, but that's not matchmaking problems.
Right.
And that's not lag. You know, EA Sports has been admirably, you know, it's been across its titles, its online multiplayer has been for the most part rock solid.
Even more impressively, I've always thought FIFA, where there you can do an online team play with like 22 people connected from all around the world. I mean, not just, well, this person lives in the next state next to me. This is all around the world. And candidly, the games are great.
Yeah, and candidly, that's why I was comfortable, you know, going to Arthur, our reviews editor, and saying we can publish, you know, NBA Live on you know, day of release, because, you know, I had faith that this was not going to face the problems, you know, that NBA 2K did in its online, you know, game. Now it's got, you know, problems or disappointments elsewhere. But, you know, those things you don't need to spend a week, you know, okay, can we actually connect to this game? You know, I had and of course, you know, the other thing too on there is EA Access. You know, if there really was problems connecting in multiplayer, I mean, we would have heard that, and we didn't. So, you know, it's like I never want to beat up developers too bad, because I know that even for a crappy game, you know, this is somebody's entire year or 2 years that they have spent, you know, working on this. And in some cases, a lot of the failures are failures of leadership or failures of funding from above. And I get that. I don't ever want to be the kind of guy who craps all over a developer and says, why'd you make a piece of bleep? But I do think that there are some baseline expectations of functionality that are just being failed. And it's like, you know, at some point somebody does have to be held accountable for that. And what you saw with Ubisoft this week was like, you know, we couldn't really go to Ubisoft Montreal and, you know, kick their ass over this, but the writers definitely dealt with Ubisoft PR. And it was like, okay, if you're going to abuse the embargo process, and I think it's also a little bit important, and I don't want to deviate too much here, but to explain why we agree to this stuff, it has to do with, you know, getting copies in advance so that you can provide a review on the day of release that is informative, but also provides, you know, somewhat of a consumer decision for people who haven't made up their mind. And you agree to that, you know, so that, you know, you don't have people rushing to beat each other out of the gate, and you feel like you have enough time to provide an accurate review. And I just, you know, Ubisoft just abused that. These publishers know where their game sits before it launches. I mean, you know, we've heard about the mock review, and I'm damn sure that Ubisoft knew internally where this thing was going to score. You know, Polygon gave it a 6.5, I think. 6.5, something like that. We knew what was up. You know, this wasn't like SimCity, where, you know, there were a bunch of play events preceding launch, and, you know, game looked beautiful and great and deep and you know, really, you know, creative. And then, you know, now you can't connect to it, and you have to go back, and it's just embarrassing as hell to take that big score that you give, which, by the way, Metacritic will not revise. If a publication revises its score downward or upward, Metacritic does not change. So, you know, you go back, you revisit that score, you grade it down. I mean, nobody ever wants to do that. And, you know, it was apparent to me that Ubisoft knew where this game was going to come in, what it was going to get killed for, and managed the release so that it could have, you know, that nice midnight lineup hype, and everybody would take it home and feel good about what they bought. And then they would send out a bunch of press releases in the morning about, you know, Assassin's Creed Unity is this, and, you know, it's in stores now, and all this other nonsense. And then the crappy reviews would come in and rip it to shreds.
Let's talk about embargoes for a second. You know, Owen, you and I both are typically, when we do reviews, now you are, you know, you work for Polygon. I'm a freelancer, but I've done a bunch of reviews for Games Radar, and we both typically have the same, you know, well, we always have the same embargoes because they are, generally speaking, across the board, except on occasion a certain site might get early access.
Mm-hmm.
What is the deal with an embargo, and why the day of release embargo? I mean, some games, like we've seen, for example, this week, Dragon Age Inquisition, the embargo was up a full week before release. Whereas NBA Live was embargoed to the day of release, which, you know, and we could argue this. I think NBA Live is kind of a good game. I'm playing it regularly right now. It was certainly not a broken, busted, you know, game that was needed to be hidden, right?
Right.
You know, NHL had an embargo of the day of release, and both NHL and Live had had early access out there, so people were experiencing the game. Why the day of release embargo? And should outlets that have power, like Polygon, like IGN, like GameSpot, should they push back on that, considering what's unfolded now, and say, you know what, don't, you know, if you're going to send us the game early, don't give us an embargo on that day of release. Let us get this out a few days beforehand. Is that something that should happen, do you think?
Well, not really. I mean, I don't think it should be a free-for-all. Like, as soon as you get code, you can publish. You know, that's because then you're going to see what nobody wants to see, which is, you know, a rushed review, because you want to be first with it, because, you know, there's a traffic win there. And also, I mean, you know, there are also video captures that run off of these things too. And if you've got video of gameplay and something, you know, that's a huge, that on its own is its own draw. I think people want some kind of a, you know, everybody's at the starting line, and then someone, you know, fires the pistol, and then it's a fair race to, you know, what happens after that is up to the publication. I think what's sort of vexing about this is, you know, there's a meta game, and Ben Kushera acknowledged this in his op-ed, which, you know, got a lot of attention because he said that Ubisoft had weaponized its reviews policy, which I think is a great way of putting it. But it's that the metagame is, well, so-and-so made this available, you know, a week in advance, and so-and-so didn't make this available at all. I mean, Sonic Boom, you know, that's its own screw up. I mean, they've got a game-breaking bug in there that lets you finish that in an hour.
Right,
but
hey,
they didn't make any copies available to reviewers at all. And
bingo.
But I think that's the thing is, well, but the thing is, I think this is where sites go. We're not reporting inside baseball. We're not commenting on our relationships or what we suspect, you know, publishers are doing or thinking behind the scenes. And it also seems a little unprofessional to you know, ascribe some kind of meta motive to these things. Even if a reasonable person can judge that a game that has consumer code out to reviewers 5 days in advance of or 5 days in advance of release, you know, is has more confidence in it than, you know, a game that's, you know, going to be on day of. But one thing that Kotaku has done, and I used to work there, Stephen Totillo, the editor in chief, this week said, you know what, we're not going to play this game anymore. If there is a game, you know, that we're going to publish our review as soon as it's available for purchase in the general population. And if anybody says, you know, you have to wait 12 hours past that, we're just going to flat ignore it. Now, that I do agree with. And I think that, frankly, other sites should follow suit, because as soon as somebody breaks an embargo, I think it's fair game for anyone else to break an embargo. I think there are some edge cases where you go, you know, somebody says, hey, look, we're not getting the servers running until thus and such time. You know, they'll be running when people bring it home, but, you know, it's not going to be running for you. And then you go, well, okay, I guess we have to wait and see, you know, there. And that's kind of fair. And then sometimes, I mean, regrettably, there are day one patches that do make the game a lot better. And so long as it's not something like, you know, if this is a patch that people can get when they bring the game home, then you sort of feel obligated to say, okay, this is, you know, I need to review the experience that people will have with this game, not the experience that preceded it. You know, so, I mean, you hear me talking in circles and you get the keen idea that this is not Roger Ebert at the movies. you know, you have so many different states of the game. It's not just the modes. It's just that the game can be completely different from patch to patch. And I think it's just, you know, like you have to call out unfair play and abusive things and not tolerate them while still, you know, giving as much of the benefit of the doubt to the people who have spent so much time building this. And that's just a hard spot to be in between.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, mainstream video game sites in particular are still grappling with how to properly approach this. You know, and you just mentioned, like, you know, Stephen Totilo says, all right, we're changing some things based upon that. And what's also interesting is after day one, how things are covered. So, perfect example, NBA 2K15 had serious problems at launch and for the first couple of weeks because basically a lot of its modes were tied to being able to be connected. And if you're not connected online, you couldn't play My Player the way you wanted to. You couldn't get to the park. The park had huge problems. We're what, 3-4 weeks later? It works great. I mean, at least every time I go into the game, it works great. No one's talking about that. Now, when NBA 2K14 launched and it was a huge problem, and a month or two later, a couple of sites were talking about that. I mean, Brian Weedy was in particular focused on that. But Owen, you published a piece for Kotaku, you know, several weeks after release, talking about it. How are the first 2 weeks after launch, the 4 weeks after launch? These are also difficult to cover because obviously a website needs to talk about the things its listeners and readers care about. How do you balance that? And Brian, you know, again, I mentioned you're very good at Pasta Padre on hitting, you know, post-release stuff, but that's because that's what you focus on. How do you feel different things are covered once the release, you know, once a game is released 2, 3, 4 weeks on, both positively and negatively?
Yeah, it's always there goes my dog again.
What's up, Rocky?
It's always bothered me how the major media sites largely ignore the sports games outside of the previews and the reviews, and then they just kind of forget it until next year's preview. So, of course, you know, I appreciate that because then all the people who are interested go to my site instead. but, you know, I would prefer, actually, if everyone got the proper information, were updated properly. I mean, so many people now go to social media for that kind of stuff, and the company accounts tend not to be as informative as they should be or as honest as they should be. But it's a difficult thing to judge for them because I don't know how their traffic is affected, but I look at sales numbers and I see NBA 2K is going to sell 6 million copies or something. Why doesn't it get the coverage that a game that sells a couple million copies does from the general gaming sites? It's kind of crazy to me that it doesn't. And I don't know why it is maybe that sports games don't draw the same eyes despite the sales numbers. But that's always kind of interested me because these are, you know, and you get the snide comments, the whole, it's just going to be a roster update or it's just a roster update, you know. And yeah, there have been a couple of those lately, MLB 2K13 and NHL 15 last gen. but for the most part, they aren't roster updates. Maybe they're not innovating the way that they used to. But yeah, it still bothers me that they aren't really treated with the same respect. They're kind of looked down upon, and it's issues like you said, Rich. I mean, it took a while of my writing about it, and then Operation Sports writing about it before other sites picked up on all the NBA 2K14 issues. It had everything, and Owen summed it up really well in his article. It had everything. It had issues with microtransactions, issues with always online, which was huge at the moment. But you compare that to the coverage that a SimCity got, or a Forza 5 got, or a Battlefield 4 got. And it's not even in the same, you know, it's insane how different it was judged, or how different it was. It wasn't even paid attention to in most places. I don't understand why that is, and it irks me to this day.
Well, what's also interesting is three of the top 10 best sellers just this past month are sports games. Number one.
Oh, and
number
and over,
one.
And they're going to be there for the whole years in sales. Every year, they're like in the top five, these three.
Yeah, number one is NBA 2K15. Despite the initial problems with online, absolutely number one. FIFA 15, number seven. And Madden NFL 15, number eight. You know, and yes, Madden had problems with desyncs in online CFM. They got fixed. NBA 2K15 had online connectivity problems. That got fixed. The park has been fixed. I mean, I'm sure there are still some issues related to it, but I certainly don't hear people complaining about it. And a lot of my friends are playing it a lot, right? So obviously, to a significant degree, it works.
People just want stability, Rich. People just want consistency and stability, which it hasn't been there.
And it's like, and it's bizarre that has somehow become like too much to expect. I mean, that's the way we're almost made to feel about this sort of thing. You know, buyer beware. This is going to be unstable at launch. Well, my God, how did that become a tolerable situation?
Well, you know, and you make a comment about it on Twitter, or you write a story about it like I do about issues with online or servers. And then you get the people who are like, get over it. It's day one.
That's such an abusive relationship. You know, no, you need to release a game that functions on day one. I'm sorry. You know, this is a $60 purchase. I think that's what, you know, again, that comes back to what you're seeing with so much anger, you know, in these mainstream games. I mean, like I said, you know, sports video gamers have put up with this, you know, for some time, because again, they're annual releases, they're iterative works, they're building on old code, and you know, there's always some kind of an online problem at launch. You know, we get that. And Brian, you know, you're right. It's like, you know, why do these games, which sell, you know, many multiples of something like, you know, SimCity or whatever, I don't know, you know, why do they not get the same kind of attention? Well, now they are, because now you're seeing a game have the problems that manifest themselves so frequently in sports video games. It's what happened with Assassin's Creed Unity. And it's like, you know, show some respect for this kind of a purchase, please. You have to. And you know, Unity's problem is not just that, you know, you got people with eyeballs and a mouth and hair and no head.
Uh-huh.
You know, which
those are great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're hilarious, and yeah, you got people falling through the floor and other things that are just sort of like basic QA, like what the hell really was going on here. But I do think on some level those things are by themselves kind of blown out of proportion, but it is that in combination with Ubisoft's behavior on disguising what it knew to be problems, you know, so that it could have this nice debutante ball launch day, and then the absolute obfuscation on microtransactions, which I can't believe I'm using that word to describe something in which you can spend $99 to get enough of this, you know, virtual bucks to I assume that with that $99 thing you unlock everything in the game. But you know what I mean, that was not a complete surprise. It was a surprise to us internally at Polygon. Yeah, I wrote the story about that, and you know, nobody that I was dealing with in our internal chat had heard of it. But Brian Crescente Googled and found like some very, very small publication, not to impugn them, but just not one of the big ones, you know, had been writing about the new forms of currency in Assassin's Creed Unity, and it was like, you know, Ubisoft plainly picked somebody who didn't have high traffic to break the news on that, I guess, so they could say they broke the news, and then everybody found out about it, you know, when the game finally came out. And so it's like all those things in conjunction just communicate a massive disrespect for the consumer.
All right, so that leads me to where I sort of want to finish the conversation, is around sports games. And do sports games actually get a fair shake? Because these games that we're talking about, you know, Assassin's Creed Unity and Drive Club and so many of these games have, not only do they have, you know, really huge teams, like 5 and 10 times the number of people working on these games, and 5 to 10 to 20 or 30 times the amount of man hours put into these games. But they're also hyped up breathlessly. I mean, it's laughable if you YouTube the E3 announcement of Drive Club. I mean, the guy who gets on stage and just breathlessly talks about how Drive Club is going to be, you know, this is the game that we've always wanted to make. It's going to be the most incredible social experience. And you cannot watch that video and not laugh, right? Or the Assassin's Creed Unity reveal at E3 where they're talking about how many people are going to be rendered on screen and stuff. It's laughable because then when you see it, nothing works. Like, this stuff just flat out doesn't work. And in sports games, and we've talked about this recently, the hype train has kind of stopped, and in a good way. Like, the last couple of years in particular, there has not been the breathless hype of new modes or how this is going to be the greatest change of all time. It's just been like, yeah, we're here are some of the improvements, and this is what we got going on, and we're very excited about it. And, they'll come on the show, and they'll talk about things a couple of weeks before they come out. But it's a very different... It's very different. And so and each of the sports games are different, right? Like MLB The Show for the PS4 came out in May. There were some people that were upset about it. But looking back, clearly it was a good thing because other than the online problems, the game was excellent. FIFA was by all means – now some people may love or not love the gameplay, but for the most part it came out and had very few technical problems. Again, you can always argue about the gameplay. Madden, other than the desyncs, and again, you can argue the quality or your particular experience with it, but overall was a well put together game. We'll talk about NHL in a minute because that's sort of, I think, a special case. But in critical analysis, when you compare what they are and who makes them and where they stand in the larger world of video games, do sports video games get a fair shake? Are the fans of the games too hard on them or not? I mean, Owen, your take on that first.
I think this cuts back to, your earlier question of, or Brian's earlier, question of, why is it that problems in sports video games don't generate the same level of outrage and that they do in titles that sell a lot fewer? I think that they do get a fair shake, and I think frankly it's because there are so few of them left. If you actually had more directly competing titles that we're releasing on the same day. I mean, again, yes, NBA 2K has a direct competitor in NBA Live. They're released on separate dates. FIFA has a direct competitor in Pro Evolution Soccer. Pro Evolution Soccer released on Tuesday, more than a month after FIFA. It's like if these things actually were head-to-head, I think you might see, a little more criticism, gusto, maybe in some cases, even a little bit people being a little bit meaner when they discuss the disappointments. But I do think that the sports publishing and the reviewers and people who are most passionate about them, who are going to be sort of your social media evangelicals, they've come to an understanding now, that nobody's going to promise them the moon, and people aren't going to expect that, and by and large, like you said, the hype train on this has slowed considerably, and it's not just because they're trying to, with NHL, hide the fact that they've removed modes. I mean, Madden NFL, is a very good game, and it's usually when you get a game, you get the reviewer guide that goes along with it.
Yeah.
And Brian, I mean, well, I guess I don't know. You guys have seen both of this, and it's a list of here's what's new, and here's everything else that's different. And Madden's was one page, and that was it. And to me, that just communicated as here's a game, wham.
Well,
play it.
I don't want to jump into a different subject, but is that just because they put all their focus now in Ultimate Team?
Well, I mean, it could be. I mean, we could speculate on it all as the day is long, but they did do different things. I mean, they obviously had different defensive camera. They did change things in CFM, some of the better, some of the worst. But I got the feeling that it was Madden has been one of those games that over the years, especially around, you know, the turn of the last decade, it was like, you know, the modes were just so nakedly designed to be marketed. And I think that the game has figured out that that just isn't going to win anymore. And I think a lot of other sports publishers have figured that out as well. I mean, like NBA 2K's biggest challenge has been taking that series, the expectations for that series, down from the eye-popping stuff that you saw with the Jordan Challenge, with NBA's Greatest, you know, then with bringing back the Dream Team and all this other stuff, and just sort of like settling this into a glide path of this is a damn good game, but we can't give you this, you know, this legacy mode that, you know, lets you relive all these great fantasies every single year. Those are the kinds of things that I see. And I, you know, Rich, I do think, I know I've rambled a lot here, but I think that they do get a fair shake. I think they get a fair shake because the online failures, you know, when they happen, if they are unacceptable for Halo, they are unacceptable for a sports title. And as long as they persist, you know, now I am fine with the 6 that we gave to NBA 2K15. That was an uncomfortable score to give, given this game's history. But since we were giving that 3 weeks after release, and yes, I know that things have smoothed out, but it doesn't matter. The game that people bought, spent $60 for, and were relentlessly anticipating for months in advance, did not function for them. You know, at launch, 1 week after, 2 weeks after, and that's, you know, that's warranted. And in some cases, that score, that low score, is warranted because you want it to send a message to them to get their act in gear once and for all next year. Don't create these new ambitious modes that have such a heavy online component if you cannot support them.
You know, one of the things that I really sort of struggle with is how to match my opinion of a game with the expectations of people at large. And there are so many different people that play sports video games. It is virtually impossible at this point to do anything other than cover the game from your own personal aspect or talk to people who care deeply about things that you don't. Like a great example, you know, TJ Larriman, big into Ultimate Team, which means that I don't have to play Ultimate Team because I can talk to TJ about it, and he's into, you know, and he goes there. You know, an example too, like, I think it's fair to say that we are all, relatively speaking, happy with Madden this year. We just finished the first year of our Madden Online franchise, where I think we had a lot of fun once the desyncs got fixed, right? And, you know, I think that we would all say that Madden is overall a very good game, or at least a good game. I think it's a very good game. But then there are people last week, for example, if you look at the comments on the episode that we did about Madden 15, 60 days later, you know, here's one of the comments from the page. It says, seriously, is anybody that understands football playing this game at all? I mean, are they not seeing the broken nonsense taking place in gameplay? Here's a small list of issues I have with the game that can all be backed up with visual video evidence. Limbs and body tangibility, poor ball tangibility, no collision awareness, broken tackling physics, broken blocking physics, broken animation sequences, broken read-react AI, broken zone coverage AI, broken man coverage AI, broken blocking logic, lack of football techniques, lack of football fundamentals, no organic awareness, rubber band AI, and there's a whole list more. Brian Wiede, are we even playing the same game as this person? Who's right? Who's wrong? How do you reconcile all of these different people having these different experiences with the same game?
Yeah, it's I think we recognize a lot of those things too. And so it's different from person to person what they can tolerate, you know, what does the fun factor cover up, essentially. And Madden's done a pretty good job of that in recent years. You know, it's deficient in a lot of areas. But, you know, are you having fun with it? And that's ultimately, you know, what a lot of people, what it comes down to. And also, it's a lot easier to look back, and I think this happens faster with sports games than it does other games. After a couple months pass, you really know everything that's wrong with the game.
Yeah.
If you play through, you know, an adventure game, a story mode game, and you finish it, you know, it's not going to stick with you that long. You didn't invest as much time. You know, people are playing hundreds of hours of Madden. You know, they're not going to play. Now, that kind of stuff does happen with the Call of Duties, but you also get people who, you know, are very critical of those games as well. But it's a lot easier to look back two and a half months later and say, okay, here's all the things that have irked me about this game. Now, the question is whether, again, we have fun in our league. If we didn't have the league, we'd probably be pointing out more issues than we have also. It's just a matter of, you know, fun factor varies from person to person. And, you know, it can be dramatically different. You know, this person might want an arcadey type of game. This person might want an ultra sim. I mean, there's an article on Operation Sports about penalties. And
penalties. Penalties are not fun. They're not.
Yeah, but
fun,
you're never going to get a consensus because it's some people want, you know, they want all these random penalties. Hey, be quiet back there. My friend's dog is here now joining the fun.
Nice.
But I mean, it's so varied from that. It's hard for not only the developers to please everyone. They can't. And I think that's often what ends up being the problems with these games. What was the problem with Madden for much of the last generation was they tried to please everyone, but they never excelled in one particular area. And now maybe they've turned away from doing the whole focusing on modes thing, like Owen was pointing out. But are they directing their resources to the right places? That's going to be a whole nother debate.
And like NBA 2K15, I mean, I didn't do a review for NBA 2K15 this year, but I guarantee you I would have personally reviewed it extremely high, because between my GM, where I am completely sucked in and having a blast, and my player, where I'm completely sucked in and having a blast, I mean, yes, there are little things that happen when I'm playing the game that I notice, but my goodness, the fun factor for me in NBA 2K15 is huge. But other people who are playing other aspects of the game, particularly when the online is not working, are just completely, you know, have miserable experiences. And then that brings us to NHL. So, again, sort of juxtapose against the disaster that Assassin's Creed Unity has been, because clearly it was too big and it could not get brought together in time for release, even though it was released. And Halo Master Chief Collection, which clearly just doesn't work. It was shipped, and they're still putting the game together now. With NHL, EA went in a different direction, which is, hey, we're just going to put a basic game together that we can put together with our team, and we're going to ship it. And, you know, because of the huge backlash that happened, they ultimately, you know, they ended up adding in a few things that, you know, I think in a perfect world they would have had in the initial shipped game, but didn't have the resources. Is it better, Owen Good, to go with a game experience that is smaller but can at least in theory be solid and stable, or to try to go for it and push the envelope and, as we've seen so often this generation, have it just be busted?
Well, you know, I understand where you're coming from there. I would also like to point out that MLB The Show, with a smaller development team, you know, obviously it was on, you know, smaller platform spread, but it was at feature parity on, you know, the new generation of consoles.
That's a great point.
What it offered on the past generation. And it is not acceptable to just strip out, you know, modes of play like EA Sports Hockey League, you know, that people have come to expect, you know, year after year, and have become, you know, reasons for buying that game. You know, that's you're selling them out, and you have no right to go, well, you should still buy this game when we removed a feature that was your main reason for buying it in the past. You know, that's just bizarre attitude, you know, to me. I understand what you're saying, which is if they didn't feel like they could put everything that had been in NHL 14 on Xbox 360 and NHL 15 on Xbox One, and that they would jeopardize the stability and playability of the game if they did, and they, you know, if they spread themselves so thin in trying to pull that off that they would, you know, put out a completely substandard game. But that's not, again, that's not my problem. You know, these are the guys, they're the ones who figure out how much, you know, time that they're going to get. And, you know, obviously their budgets are set by people above them who run the numbers and figure out how much money they're going to make on this license. And that's, you know, this is how much you get when you're going to make the game. But, you know, the other thing that's unacceptable about this is how it was marketed. I mean, you know, I saw NHL 15 at a pre-E3 event in Santa Monica in May. And I came out of that thinking, wow, this is a dark horse game for, like, sports game of the year. And that was all based on, you know, this expectation that it still had everything else that I knew was in this game, you know, in the preceding year. And I think Kat Bailey, not on this show, but, you know, a longtime panelist with us on the Press Row podcast, I think she said something to the same effect in her review. And that's just, you can't be in that position. And you have to market things a little bit more honestly than that. It's like this, you know, I don't expect the marketing operation really to give a damn about my priorities as a newsman. Some do. Anthony Stevenson over at EA Sports is actually somebody who really does. He's a straight shooter from marketing operation, rare straight shooter. But that's where PR has to step in and go, hey, wait a minute. Okay, we're assisting in the marketing and the publicity of this game, but we have a relationship with these writers, and we can't just retail horse bleep to them, you know, in this way or pull the rug out from under them at the end. And that's, you know, Ubisoft should have had somebody step up to say, look, we understand why we're marketing it in this way and why we're, you know, making these decisions in this way and why we're holding this information out in this way. But this is all going to add up to looking like we're lying to the public. And we can't have that because then we look bad. And that is bad PR. And we just saw a disaster PR operation on Assassin's Creed Unity, and I think they're rightly getting slapped across the face for it.
Brian Weedy?
Yeah. Owen, you know, in talking about NHL, brought me back to a point I wanted to make, and that's, you know, so often consumers in sports games are asked to buy games that are essentially incomplete. I mean, how many times have we heard the saying, oh, this is just a good foundation for the future, or this is year one of our 3-year plan. The three-year plan is so cliche at this point. yet people are still expected to pay full price for these admittedly incomplete products. And, you know, you're not investing in these games. Like, the EA would like you to think you're investing in the series by buying NBA Live this year, because in 2017, oh, it's going to blow your socks off, you know. That's not how it works. Instead, you've invested $180 or $240 in the series for games that didn't live up to what they should have been. So that constantly offends me is the whole idea that you know, you're buying something because of its future potential, when in sports games there is no future potential. It's what you have now, and yet, you know, they still ask for the same $60.
Yeah, but I think one key difference is a sports game has to come out every single year. I mean, there is extremely little leeway. I mean, NBA Live was able to delay 3 weeks to what we all sort of understand is the absolute latest they could release and not face some serious problems with their relationship with the NBA. Yep. You know, if a sports game doesn't come out 1 year, that is disastrous for everybody involved. Whereas Assassin's Creed Unity or Halo Master Chief Collection could have been delayed for a month or six months or whatever until it's ready to go.
Owen's probably going to say the same thing I was going to say, which is they couldn't miss Black Friday.
No, they can't. I mean, yeah. this is a huge, you know, this is probably Ubisoft's biggest franchise, and they can't put this thing on February and just not have it out after what they've told investors. I mean, it's like, you know, the thing is, on the one hand, it's like, what are they telling gamers? And then, oops, they disappoint gamers and everybody's pissed off. But, you know, I believe that Ubisoft's stock price tanked by 9% from Tuesday to Wednesday. And, you know, who knows what it could be for, but it's, you know, correlative at least, you know, to Assassin's Creed Unity getting its ass kicked. And so it's like, you know, you can disappoint consumers, but you can't disappoint them shareholders, man.
Yeah.
Well, that's really sort of my last question is, for all of the hand-wringing of, you know, shipping games that don't work at launch and for upsetting the core, does any of this really matter? I mean, if you look at some of the quotes from the last few days, relatively speaking, a lot of the video, other than, you know, the one day significant drop in Ubisoft, Ubisoft, a lot of these, the financials have been significantly better over the last few months than they have been for years. In fact, there was a piece today on CNN Money how, you know, Sony and Microsoft are both, you know, experiencing significantly larger sales of their platforms than they were expecting, and it should be a banner holiday season for Electronic Arts and for Activision. So does all of this matter? Because all of these companies, EA and Activision and Ubisoft, have all you know, committed various offenses when it comes to shipping games that did not work at launch, and for some cases extended periods beyond. You know, Microsoft, you know, with and sometimes even first party stuff like Microsoft with the Master Chief Collection and Sony with Drive Club. Like, it's not endemic to a single platform or a single publisher. It is across the board. Yet in some ways it feels like it actually doesn't matter. Does it actually matter, or is the much broader constituency just unaware of these things and just like sheep go out and buy these games when they come out?
Rich, it matters. It matters. Brands take a hit. I mean, you may not see it immediately, but over – we're talking about generally here, we're talking about series that expand, you know, over the years. And – they take a hit, and then the credibility degrades, and you see what, you know, we didn't have a Battlefield game this year. Would we have if Battlefield 4 launched to spectacular reviews last year? Yeah, probably. Instead, they delayed the one they were going to release. So they learn, you know, eventually. Sometimes it takes longer than we would like. They learn from this stuff, and you already see some of these publishers now talking about they're not going to do post-release embargoes. And they're trying, or you know, they're trying to explain things away, or whatever it might be. But they have to respond to it, and that certainly influences what they do in the future. And you see it with in sports games too. You see it; they learn from their mistakes, and whether they respond to them or not really determines future success. It just takes a while to see that all materialize, I think, and that's why you don't get the instant results. You know, in a few weeks. Ubisoft will talk about its great sales for Unity or whatever. They'll send out a press release and make it seem like all is good, but really behind the scenes it's not. And it's going to alter the way they deal with things in the future.
What I would say on top of that is, I mean, these things are happening when, if these problems are happening when kids are opening their games for Christmas, you know, that's why I think the NBA 2K 14 thing was such a scandal last year, is because that was going on as people were, you know, opening this up under their tree.
It was, and down also for like a week.
And not only that, I mean, I believe, you know, on the completely other end of the spectrum, wasn't there some problem with Pokemon and Nintendo around the time of Christmas last year too? I mean, I'm not up on my Pokemon, but there was a big issue with something that was supposed to be available for download, and like the servers were just completely hammered because everybody bought the game on Christmas and nobody could play it. So when it's easy to say that this is inside baseball and that the people who care deeply about this as a subject to be followed every day, obviously the writers and then the ultra core, you know, yes, it matters, and we have disproportionate expectations, and the public that actually is the muscle that you know creates the sales that perpetuate these series, you know, largely don't care about this because, I don't know, they're not buying it on day one or something else is happening. It's easy to sort of say that. But if you disappoint the larger public when it actually is playing that game, and that's going to be – I mean, if – you know, I guess Assassin's Creed is going to get its act together by Christmas Day, you know, because there will be a lot of people who play it for the first time on that day. And if they don't, then it's really going to be – you know, bad. I mean, that could be franchise. Well, I don't know. It'd be franchise tanking. But this is a series that, you know, critically didn't do anything imaginative, and then structurally failed. And I think people are going to remember that, you know, coming around next year. So it's sort of a hybrid of agreeing with Brian, but also agreeing with him in a different way. If these problems are out on Christmas Day, you know, especially with something like Sonic Boom, if little kids can't play that game or play it properly on Christmas Day, you know, it's like, why did they even make it?
Ah, nothing like the Christmas tradition of slicing throats, chopping heads, and stabbing eyeballs on Christmas morning.
You love it, Rich.
Family delight. Yeah. All right, well, I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to especially thank Owen Good and Brian Weedye for coming on for a very timely, very sort of a last-minute, but I think important discussion. Obviously, this is a sports game podcast, and we brought sports games into it, but it's a bigger picture item for all of us that love video games and that love playing video games with our friends. How long will we accept delivery after delivery of experiences that to some degrees don't work and in some cases just completely don't work? And how do we potentially use our collective powers to get the decisions made that make it better for everybody? It's not, one of the things that I talk about a lot is I'm not trying to be a complainer or a whiner. I'd rather there be less that works than more that doesn't. But at the end of the day, this is an expensive hobby. It's an expensive industry, and it's an industry that is in constant evolution, constantly changing. And I'm glad that Owen and Brian came on for the discussion. I'm sure there will be points we'll talk about moving forward. But thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Owen and Brian, for being on the show tonight. And for Owen Good from Polygon and Brian Weedye from Pasta Padre, I am Rich Grisham. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Well, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Press Row Podcast, brought to you by Operation Sports. We ask that you please subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher and the Windows phones. We also ask that you give us a rating. That really helps us a lot. We also ask that you please follow each of our panelists on Twitter, and they are as follows. Polygon's Owen Good at Owen Good. Pasta Padre's Brian Weedye at Pasta Padre. Polygon Submits Our Car at Submits Our Car. That Sports Gamer's TJ Lowerman at That Sports Gamer. US Gamer's Cat Bailey at @_CatBot. Operation Sports Chris Sanner at ChrisSNR. And Operation Sports Steve No at Steve_OS. And of course me, Rich Grisham at Rich Grisham. So thank you so much for listening to the show. We really appreciate it, and we really want to thank the great people at Operation Sports for making this show happen every single week. So thanks, and we'll see you again next time.